session number 14582, Reel 10.
Stephen Dale, Reel 10.
Yes, 28 days, 3 months, and 17 days. I figured that out before, on the day before I retired, and it was a fantastic party they gave me. There are 130 people sitting down to a dinner at the Ironmongers Hall, and there were speeches, and very nice speeches, and some very feeble retirement for myself, because I was completely overwhelmed. It was a great moment. I enjoyed my writing life. I had job satisfaction. I became a director of a company, which in turn was a subsidiary of one of the most successful ever companies in the field of commodities. It was an American company. It doesn't exist anymore. Everything goes. Even the British Empire doesn't know what it used to be. I can look back at my time as a period of job satisfaction, and I think that's very important.
When were you naturalised? And was there any problem about this?
There was a silly problem. When I married Doreen, she lost her British nationality, and she was issued with a passport saying, British subject by birth and by naturalization. Now, before she got this passport, she had to get her naturalization. It was a piece of paper. I mean, it sounds incredible today to a few, but I mean, that's how it was. She had to get this piece of paper saying that she was a British subject by naturalization, and then she would get her passport. But she lost that piece before it was signed. She was sent the piece. She had to take it to a commissioner for oath or something like that and sign it in his presence, and she lost it. And it was terrible, but that delayed my naturalization by several months because she had to get a new piece of paper, and these things in the civil service took a long time in those days. I was hoping, obviously, like every other alien in the thought that immediately after the war you would be naturalized. No, nothing of the sort. It took months and in some cases years. I must look it up. I think I was naturalized in 1946, and it was a great moment in my life. It was even more important than leaving the company, of course. It was a great moment. I also remember being walking around the house singing Land of Hope and Glory and British Grenadiers. But to me, to be British was wonderful. I mean, it was the nationality I wanted to have, because I had the idea that there was no country in the world which was as stable and as democratic and yet of some consequence in the world as Britain was. To have a British passport really meant something. Certainly before the war. Since the war, things have deteriorated very materially, I'm afraid. I mean, I'm still happy to be British, very happy to be British. I wouldn't want to be anything else, because after all, I mean, I've lived here since 1939, which is now a good many years, and I'm married here, I've got a family here. I mean, this is my home. This is my home, as simple as that. And even if a question in the House of Commons in the 1930s would have made the world sit up and take notice, I mean, today nobody cares a damn. It's a good country. It's a nice country. It's a beautiful country. It's got the people are thoroughly decent. I can talk about that with personal, deep personal experience, and also experiences which my sister has made, but it no longer is, obviously no longer is a world power. I think we're in danger of going down into the third division. That's the sad aspect, I must say. It's not because I wanted to have be a member of a nation which is number one, and but it's, I think we've lost integrity. I think it's a rickety infrastructure which we're living with, which is continuing to deteriorate. I think in politics we aren't as honest as we might be, or might were, or at least how I looked upon it at the time. But on balance, I'm still happy, very, very happy to be here.
I suppose the other side of the coin is Germany's rise, isn't it, after the war? You know, Germany has done so
yes.
well.
Well, I mean, it's I'm not given to envy. Good luck to them. They certainly, immediately after the war, they got a lot of help from the Allies to put them back on their feet. And while our industry was struggling with outmoded methods and ancient equipment, things were facilitated for them by having the latest equipment and taking up the newest methods of operating. Even their unions, which were based revived with the help of British trade unionists, were living in the 20th century, and unlike us, we were still hankering after the Luddite days in many ways. All that conspired to form a basis onto which they built with devoted, hard, very hard work, and they have now achieved a standard which is fantastic. The only setback they had in the expansion of their standard of living was when reunification took place after the Berlin Wall came down.
Does the rise of neo-Nazism in Germany worry you at all? You know, we hear a lot of talk about the rise of neo-Nazism.
This is most disturbing, but my friends in Germany assure me this is very much a surface manifestation on which the press concentrates, the press everywhere. I hope they're right. I hope they're right. But you know, you've got similar situations in other countries of the world, not only in Germany. So it is disturbing generally, although perhaps one automatically focuses more on Germany in the light of history.
One also hears, you know, that the Holocaust is being questioned in certain quarters. You know, have you
well,
any?
Well, this must be political motivations. There must be political motivations behind that and nothing else. I mean, this is so well documented, nobody can have any doubts that the Holocaust took place. It is not the figment of Jewish imagination or something like that.
What is your view on memorials to the Holocaust? Is there any one that you feel is outstanding?
Well, I've seen several in various parts of the world. But the one that is outstanding is the Bat Hashem in Jerusalem, which is I found overwhelming. It's quite incredible. I find it difficult to describe it. It's very, very moving to go there, and I can't see how anybody can remain unmoved as a memorial.
When you look back, you know, at the time of coming to Britain as a refugee, what was your opinion of these sort of organisations, particularly the Jewish organisations which were there? Were you given enough help, do you think?
what was done by in this country, and not in, but predominantly by Jews, but not exclusively by Jews, for refugees was really fantastic. You could always argue that not enough was done, it's perfectly true, but it was to a large extent the good nature and the good will and the desire to do something useful in a terrible situation, which brought to this country, I don't know what the numbers are, it must have been tremendous numbers. I forget, I knew it one time, but I can imagine it's 100,000 people or more. And to cope with that, to integrate them, to find jobs for them, to feed them, to clothe them, medical care. In many cases, there was psychological care needed too, because I remember some arrivals of young people from concentration camps who were obviously not in possession of all their faculties. But they were taken care of one way or the other. And I think what was done was tremendous. You could turn around and say not enough was done, but then that's always the case. In whatever situation you find yourself where you where help is extended in case of need or emergency, but there's never enough done. But in this country, the will to do something was really quite overwhelming, touching. The organizations I came into, who looked after me, very unobtrusive in the background, and they were of help to me. They found a home for me. It was they who arranged to go for me to go to a college to become an officer in the merchant service. After that, I don't think I've ever called upon their help, I'm happy to say. But these organizations, I believe, still exist. And I don't know what they're doing now. I mean, I'm completely out of touch. I mean, happy to say that I have no need to call on them.
You mentioned the number of refugees, the German refugees who came. How would you rate their contribution to British society?
I think quite good. I don't want to exaggerate it, but there are quite a number of names who've come to prominence in the field of the arts, in the field of science and commerce. I don't know how to quantify contributions of that nature, but I'm sure they must have had altogether a very positive influence. I can't see any really negative influence. I mean, if you disregard phenomena like Maxwell, who came to this country as a refugee and at one time was sort of held up as one of the great success stories. I mean, let's see what end he's come to, but I'm glad to say that I don't think there have been very many. I think by and large the contribution was positive and was definitely there.
Can you think of any particular sort of attribute which helps a person to adapt to a new country? In your own case, for instance, what do you think it was necessary to have or to do in order to integrate?
Well, I think in the first place, the willingness to integrate. Absence of preconceived ideas on subjects with which one isn't really very familiar. Recognition that if you are in a situation in which I found myself, where I am the beneficiary of facilities made available to me in a foreign country, one's got to have a sense as to what is acceptable and what is not, and has to realize that characteristics of the people and habits and customs in the country to which you have come are bound to be different from the country you have left. And I think it is vital that these are recognized by whoever finds himself in a position like that. Also, I think there is some need to appreciate what has been done, to express that at some stage, not in a gushing manner, but sort of factually, that one recognizes one owes something to the country and the people who have taken you in.
I haven't asked you at all about language, have I? I know at several points in the interview I was very much wanting to know what your English was like, say, when you came to Britain in the first case.
At school, my first foreign language was French, then I had Latin, and then English. I didn't have much English at school because I left school relatively early. I always wanted to improve my English, and I've never got rid of my accent, but I think I've got a fair command of English, and whether this is probably good luck. I don't know whether some people have a facility for learning languages, others have not. I mean, we've got one son who's a mathematician who's absolutely useless as far as language is concerned, and we have one daughter who took French and Spanish for A-levels, and then took Chinese, a course in Chinese and Chinese history, which involved, I forget how many words and characters which she had to know, but her Chinese was perfectly adequate for everyday usage. And then she went to live in Japan and learned Japanese. So, I mean, there's obviously a talent there. I don't think I'm specifically talented. My English is reasonable. In terms of accent, it's poor. I've got a good command of. I've got a good vocabulary. My spelling is good. I've dabbled in sort of other languages, but very, very superficially, like Italian and Dutch, but I can hear what people are talking about in Dutch, but I can't really speak it now. I used to travel quite often to Holland at one time, and it was better. I think it's something one inherits. I've got no idea what my parents were like as linguists, but certainly my mother-in-law is first class. I mean, she could. She gave the impression of being able to speak any language, but she certainly had. English was her native language, but she also spoke German, French, and Dutch. So, and therefore, I mean, she had no problem in conversing in any language.
Were you given language training in SOE?
No, there was no language training in SOE because I belong to the German and Austrian country section, and it was assumed that somehow our paths would lead into Germany or Austria. In my case, of course, it didn't. Other people of my group went into Germany and into Austria at various dates. No, there was no training in languages at all. I mean, we're trained in making our own explosives. I suppose I might have been a useful recruit for the IRA at some stage. I mean, we were taught burglary.
Could I ask you now a little more about the Pioneer Corps? You know, you've explained very much your sort of reaction to this, but I would imagine, you know, with people like yourself going in and other German refugees. It must have been a very varied group in the Pioneer Corps.
Well, the Pioneer Corps company I was in was an alien company. In other words, there weren't any British in it. In my company were predominantly German and Austrian, and it was, I don't know really, would you care to be a little bit more specific, because I can only, my attitude towards the Pioneer Corps was very negative, because I didn't want to be in it, and consequently I was inclined to dislike the people in the company. They were perfectly nice people, some I got on famously, some I knew before, and some I've met since. But by and large, it was not an area which I wanted to be in.
Yes, it was just when you were saying, you know, that like the people on the... when you were talking about the Pioneer Corps, you said they were the sort of dregs of humanity.
Yes, that's perfectly true. But you see, there were other Pioneer Corps companies which were not alien companies, and they were the lowest of the lowest. I think, as far as I can judge, I mean, people who were deemed unsuitable for service in more demanding units were just put into the Pioneer Corps, because we had, in those days, we had conscription. People had to serve in the army. And, I mean, you can't make a soup purse out of a sow's ear, to coin an absolutely new phrase. there were people who didn't have the background or mental ability, I mean, to cope with things which were a little bit more demanding than wielding a shovel. And one of the reasons why aliens were put in the army altogether was that if you had a company of, let's say, 300 soldiers who were all aliens, at least you knew where they were. You had a measure of control over them. And in the early days, they weren't allowed any arms. Therefore, I mean, they weren't really a danger to anybody. But that gradually changed. I think those people who wanted to and those people who had sufficient goal got out of the Pioneer Corps, and it was something which was encouraged, because it was felt they could make better contributions than doing highly unintelligent work as they were expected to do in the Pioneer Corps.
So finally, could I ask you how you feel about, you know, the world today? Do you feel sort of optimistic or pessimistic about, you know, the prospects for peace?
That really is a tall order to answer in a few sentences. I've always been, and perhaps still am, a starry-eyed idealist. By nature, I would have preferred to be a conscientious objector or a pacifist during the last World War, I don't like the idea of killing. That's why I'm against the death sentence. It's not a sort of on high moral grounds, although that comes into it, but I think as far as the death penalty is concerned, very often mistakes are made which then cannot be no longer be rectified. I think it's very cruel to keep people in prison forever and ever as well. I got into the war because I felt it was necessary to defeat the evil of Nazism. I hoped, I was always optimistic that in the end the Nazis would be defeated. Now, it was of course touch and go looking back, but perhaps my optimism was also a form of self-defense, if one put it like that, because I felt if I didn't believe in it, was worth life worth living in my particular position. I wanted to believe that the Nazis could be defeated, and they were defeated. equally, I want to believe that there is good in mankind altogether, although it is extremely difficult to be wholeheartedly a believer in that. I'm a completely irreligious person. I'm an atheist. I cannot lean on something else. I feel I've got to cope with problems by myself. Therefore, I joined the army because I felt it was the right thing to do, and I still believe it was the right thing to do. In fact, after the war, I got involved through somebody in the government approached me whether I wanted to join, whether I wanted to help them in a particular manner, and they explained to me what it was, and it turned out to be to work for a civilian agency of NATO. I agreed to that because I felt I owed it to this country to do something positive to maintain a way of life which I thought was vastly superior to any others I knew. And I therefore joined this organization called CSA, Civil Supply Agency, I think it meant. And I worked with them for, I think it must have been something like 25 years. It was interesting, but equally it was quite useless from my point of view, because NATO may have been a deterrent, but in an actual emergency, I don't think it would have been perfectly efficient. I'm saying that on the assumption that the enemies of NATO would have been more efficient. I've got no proof of that, but I felt very strongly that NATO was not efficient. In fact, I felt so strongly about it that I wrote a letter to Carrington, Lord Carrington, who was then the Secretary General, and I got sort of a letter from signed by a second in command, which was probably dictated by a third in command, and sort of fobbing me off to me nonsensical arguments. And I felt that the degree of preparedness of this particular organization to which I belonged was totally inadequate. What I have no idea about is the allocation of funds, who decided them, and who gave priorities to them. But I came to the opinion that while Britain was willing to play an important part in NATO, probably a bigger part than their economic background would warrant, the real power, without a shadow of a doubt, were the United States, who would have done everything on their own without any other country's help or assistance or contribution. They would have carried the Canadians with them, and they would always have been happy to have the certain support of Britain, of which they, I'm sure, could rely entirely. But I don't think Britain was very highly rated. The other countries who, in my opinion, were useful to NATO were Norway and Holland. But as far as the French are concerned, I mean, you never knew whether they were in something or out of something. And the others, to my mind, absolutely have no consequence.